Welcome to World War I Centennial News. It's about World War I news 100 years ago this week, and it's about World War I now, news and updates about the centennial and the commemoration. World War I Centennial News is brought to you by the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission and the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Today is March 29, 2017. I'm Teo Mayer, Chief Technologist for the World War I Centennial Commission, and your host today. It's the week before the centennial of America's declaration of war, and that's certainly going to be a key topic for today's program, starting with 100 years ago this week. Mike Schuster from the Great War Project is with us today. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Teo.
Hey, Mike, I read your post this week, and it talks about a really messy situation in Europe and a huge catharsis of conscience here in the U.S. Mike, tell us how it all plays out.
The headlines read, "War fever builds in U.S. Wilson's cabinet votes for war, but disagree on how to support it. Thousands meet, cheer for war." And this is special to the Great War Project. Stalemate, bloody and murderous stalemate. That's the state of play for the contending powers at this moment in the Great War a century ago. Even as Russia plunges into political chaos, writes historian Martin Gilbert, the war fronts continue to see facing armies unable to gain decisive advantage. After months of horrible bloodshed, the Germans had withdrawn from the Somme in northern France without loss to their new defensive line. The British are making progress in Mesopotamia, now Iraq. After struggling to regroup after the terrible defeat at the hands of the Ottoman Turks at the town of Kut, the British go on the offensive. Baghdad falls to the British, who then capture the town of Bakuba. At this point, a century ago, war fever is beginning to build in the United States. On March 20th, Wilson holds a cabinet meeting at which all of its members express support for the war. Secretary of State Robert Lansing writes, "The American action could determine the destinies of the United States and possibly the world." Writes historian Margaret Wagner, "Undoubtedly stirred by the revolution in Russia and the recent ship losses, all of Wilson's cabinet members conclude that war with Germany is now inevitable. But several argue that the best way for the United States to aid the war effort is support the Allies financially with naval assistance and by continuing the flow of supplies. With many others in government, reports Wagner, they believe the country could not and should not field an army overseas. Wilson announces that he will convene a special session of Congress on April 2nd to receive a communication concerning grave matters of national policy. Writes historian Wagner, though a decision for war remained uncertain, the president ordered the U.S. ambassador and American relief workers to leave occupied Belgium. Wilson also orders the Navy to establish ways of cooperating with the British Navy. Quietly, Wilson is taking preliminary steps to prepare the nation for war. The head of the U.S. Naval War College is dispatched to London to act as covert liaison. In civilian clothes, writes Wagner, and under an assumed name. When the naval crewmen manning the ship's guns recognized him, Wagner reports, the admiral quickly impressed on them the importance of keeping his secret. Support for war among American civilian population begins to build. In New York's Madison Square Garden, 12,000 cheered for war, and more thousands gathered at Carnegie Hall the following day. That meeting turns violent. Reports the New York Times, clashes between patriots and pacifists break out. New York's mayor proclaims the United States is about to go to war for democracy. Tonight, he declares, we are divided into only two classes, Americans and traitors. And that's some of the outlines from this week from the Great War Project.
Thank you, Mike. Now let's find out what's happening in the Great War in the Sky 100 years ago this week. Starting next week, we enter what is known as Bloody April, all related to a British offensive called the Battle of Arras. But this week, at the end of March 1917, we meet a Canadian-born lieutenant, Billy Bishop, another colorful aviator. Early on as a cadet, he earned the acclaim as a hotshot, and I mean a sharpshooter. It was said that he could hit a target that others could only see as dots. He went to war as an infantry spotter and hated it. Most of all, he hated the mud and the trenches. Having spotted an RFC plane, he reputedly declared, "I'll bet it's clean up there, and you don't have any mud or horse shit on you, and when you die, at least it'll be a clean death. And so he joined the Royal Flying Corps and trained to be a pilot. I'm sure the story is not quite all that neat, but the fact is that on March 25th, 1917, Bishop shoots down a German Albatross D-3 as his first aerial combat victory. And that's number one in a tally that goes to 72, making him the UK's top ace. And unlike so many others, he survives World War I, including a famous encounter with Baron von Richthofen, the Red Baron. The Germans called Billy Bishop Hell's handmaiden and promptly put a big price on his head, but nobody collects, and Billy Bishop goes on to head UK's aerial training plan for World War II and then lives on to 1956. A pilot who began his career as a World War I flying ace 100 years ago this week. We invite you to learn more about the war in the sky from R.G. Head's wonderful timeline that you'll find on our website at www.cc.org/war-in-the-sky. On to history on YouTube. The Great War Channel, the channel that shows you the history of the First World War exactly 100 years ago from a more European perspective. We encourage our listeners to check it out. It's really great. This week, the Great War Channel's new episodes include Champion for Democracy, Woodrow Wilson. Comparing World War I helmet designs. I think I'm going to watch that one. And Kaiser Karl Wants Peace, the Sixtus Affair. Zooming forward to the present, it's time for World War I Now. News and events about the centennial and the commemoration. First, we have some commission news. Teresa Sims, Strategic Relations at the World War I Centennial Commission, will be speaking with Commissioner Monique Seyfried. They'll be giving you some insights about the upcoming April 6th event in Kansas City. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Teo. Monique, it's wonderful to get an opportunity to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule. I know we've got just a little over a week before we'll all be in Kansas City for the In Sacrifice for Liberty and Peace Centennial Commemoration for U.S. Entry into War. So could you describe what's going on in April 6th in Kansas City and what you think are the highlights?
Teresa, I think that on Kansas City, we will have a major national and international event that will bring back to us the importance of the entry of the United States in World War I 100 years ago. So the day will start at 9 a.m. You will have a pre-program starting on the ground of the Liberty Memorial in Kansas City, the place where in 1921 the first National World War I Museum was started. It was inaugurated several years later by President Coolidge. And the reason for Kansas City is that the citizens of Kansas City were really the first one to want to remember their soldiers. It was also a place where Union Station was important because veterans from all over the country could meet coming from west and east. So between 9 o'clock and 10:30, we will have pre-programming going on the wonderful screens that will be installed on both sides of the Liberty Memorial Tower. And we will set up the stage for what is going to be an incredible ceremony where we are very fortunate to have Ed Billut as an artistic director and his team. Ed Billut is the director of innovative programming at the Juilliard School, and he has put together a series of montage of video, of photographs, of music from the band. And for an hour and a half, the public will be able to see live as well as on television what happened in the United States in the months preceding the entry of the U.S. in the war. The public will be able to listen to the debate that took place of the Americans who spoke against the war and the Americans who spoke about entering the war. We will also be showing scenes from the front of the terrible devastation that was happening, of the millions of deaths that were taking place during that time. We mentioned the American volunteers who decided to intervene earlier on before the U.S. entered the war and fought on the side of the Allies, as well as the American nurses that from the end of 1914 went on to serve as nurses for the British and the French on the front. So it will be really an incredible dialogue. It will plunge the public in the event of 100 years ago. So that is what we are presenting on that day. What impact of the event is hopefully going to have is to awaken the American public on this extremely important event, because World War I transformed the United States. It made an enormous impact on the world, but in the U.S., it changes nearly everything. If you think about the political system, about the economic system, about so many social aspects of our society that were transformed after World War I. You can speak also about all the innovation in the arts, in medicine, in technology. There are so many events that go back to World War I, and I think it's important for Americans to remember that, as well as to remember that we, as Americans, entered the war to bring peace to a devastated world.
Thank you, Monique, and thank you also for your leadership. We look forward to seeing more and to being able to watch this unfold next week. And I hope everyone in our audience will join us. It will be live streamed. Thank you again, and thank you, Teo.
Thank you very much. The URL for the live stream is ww1cc.org/April 6th, all lowercase. So if you want to see the event, you can go ahead and tune in. And I think we're going to be going live probably right around 9 a.m., and it'll go right through 12:30. You can check in and check out. Also, later that day, we're going to be live casting a colloquium with a bunch of experts in the field who are going to be speaking from a more academic standpoint, what's going on and so forth, and that will also be at the same place, and you can watch those streams. Thank you very much. Next, we're going to talk about Robert Laplander. He's the author of The Lost Battalion. He's also the spearhead of the Doughboy MIA project, which we host on the World War I Commission's website. On that site, Rob has an amazing searchable database of the World War I MIAs. You'll find it at ww1cc.org/MIA, all lowercase. You may not know this, but there are still more than 4,400 MIAs from World War I, and the U.S. government's no longer trying to resolve the cases. But Robert Laplander and his volunteers are. Their motto, a man is only lost if he's forgotten, and they keep the search alive. But that's not the story. Earlier last year, on his own nickel, Mr. Laplander came to D.C., and with the help of one of our commission interns, he scoured some physical records and noted a doubling up of a name on the official ABMC rolls. And last week, the ABMC officially agreed with their findings and have adjusted the roll to reflect such. We thank Robert Laplander and the Doughboy MIA Project. Thanks to their dedication, our World War I MIAs are not forgotten. Speaking of veterans and World War I, the Veterans of Foreign Wars have built a new VFW and World War I section on the Commission's website, and it launched yesterday at ww1cc.org/VFW. The VFW is the first major veterans organization that's publishing World War I information on our site. We welcome them and we thank them for their participation. The VFW is actively supporting the Centennial and are the presenting sponsor for the April 6th commemoration event in Kansas City. The Declaration of War Centennial is just a week away, and with events being planned all over the U.S. and actually all over the world, we wanted to remind you of a great resource that we have for you, your organization, and your classroom. Actor Gary Sinise narrated a wonderful series of informational videos called They Deserve Their Own Memorial. There's a 7-minute version that's great for the classroom. There's a 3-minute version that's ideal for fundraisers and special events. And there are even 30-second and 60-second PSAs, public service announcement videos, that you can use as you like. Go to our video library at ww1cc.org/video where you'll find these. There is a download button that you can use for sharing, downloading, or embedding on your own site. And now for an update from the states. First of all, there are April 6th events happening all over the country. See the National Commemoration website at ww1cc.org/April6th and check out the side menu under the Events Around the Country, or go to the National Events Register at ww1cc.org events and filter down to your state. And before we move on, a quick note to our state partners. There won't be a state outreach call for the month of April. The next one will be held on Thursday, May 4th. We welcome you then. Now we widen our view with the International Report. Just a quick story we picked up because it's funny. From the UK, the headline reads, "Bulldog spirit, defiant first World War I postcards show the unbreakable spirit of the British people during German bombing raids. A new collection of postcards reveals the Brits' defiant sense of humor in the face of the threat from above." Belonging to aviation expert David Marks, this fascinating archive has been brought together for a new book. During the war, people caught in bombing raids often sent cards to loved ones to let them know that they survived. Take a moment to check out these visuals. They're really a fun look. For 100 Cities, 100 Memorials, there's a new program taking root in America. And sorry, that's actually a pun, because with us today is Dr. John Marks, the program coordinator for Saving Hallowed Ground's Memorial Tree Program. John is a historian who received his PhD in history from Rice University in 2016. John, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, John, tell us a little bit about Saving Hallowed Ground's Memorial Tree Program. I just learned about it recently. In fact, I've learned recently about all of the memorial groves and tree projects that are, in fact, U.S. memorials. This is very interesting.
Absolutely. So Saving Hallowed Ground is a nonprofit organization that promotes engagement with and appreciation of the past by connecting individuals and communities with historic preservation and commemoration initiatives. And one of the initiatives we're really most focused on right now is our Memorial Tree Program, which plants trees throughout the country to honor and commemorate contributions to World War I made both at home and abroad. And as you alluded to, one of the things that I really find most interesting about the program is the fact that this is actually a revival of sorts of a program that began during World War I itself. Beginning in 1914 and continuing through the post-war era, different memorial groups, veterans organizations, and others planted memorial trees, memorial groves throughout the United States and really around the world. One of Saving Hallowed Ground's board members, Barbara Saletti, and one of our advisory board members, Sarah Pilling, discovered information about this original memorial tree program while they were researching for the World War I centennial commemoration efforts here in Pennsylvania. And they came to Saving Hallowed Ground and proposed that we try to revive this effort as part of our efforts to commemorate the World War I centennial. So since that time, a couple years ago, Saving Hallowed Ground has planted, over the last 6 months, nearly a dozen trees in 2 states, and we have plans to plant trees in nearly 5 more states in the coming months. So this Memorial Tree Program really offers a great way for communities and states to commemorate and share their unique local World War I history, and then also to connect it to this more national project. If there are communities who are interested in participating in the Memorial Tree Program, we would really love to hear from you. If folks are interested in learning more, they can find our website at savinghallowedground.org, and they can find our Facebook page and our Twitter page and our Instagram account there. And I'd also just briefly like to thank the Uncommon Individual Foundation, who funds all of this great work that Saving Hallowed Ground is able to do to commemorate the World War I centennial.
So, John, you know, I'm the program manager for 100 Cities, 100 Memorials, and I think that these programs, many of them would qualify for the matching grants. That program has up to $2,000 matching grants for the restoration and or the creation of new World War I memorials?
Yeah, we definitely encourage people to look into the 100 Cities, 100 Memorials project, especially because some of our other programs involve the restoration of World War I memorials. So if there's a group that's looking to both plant a tree and to try to restore some existing World War I memorials, Saving Hallowed Ground would be able to help out and organize those programs in communities around the country.
The application period for the grants for 100 Cities, 100 Memorials is closing on June 15th, so if you want to put a project together, go to the website at ww1cc.org/100memorials and see what it takes to apply for a matching grant. John, thank you for coming on. I think you guys are doing fabulous work, and the link to Saving Hallowed Ground is in the chat room. Thank you. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Last week on The Buzz, Catherine Akey highlighted an article in the Huffington Post about the noble sacrifice of our nation's horse and mules during the Great War. With us today is Brooke USA's Special Events and Outreach Manager, Cindy Ruhlman. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Teo. I'm delighted to have an opportunity to talk about America's horses and mules in World War I.
Well, Cindy, tell us more about our equine heroes.
But what we know so far is that there were approximately 1 million horses and mules who were shipped to England and then on to France from the United States during the 3 years prior to the United States entering World War I. And those animals were used for extremely important tasks, such as transporting guns and ammunition to the front lines. They carried men into battle. They carried wounded men back to safety. They transported food, water, medical supplies, you know, everything imaginable through terribly, terribly difficult situations. What we want to do through our Horse Heroes program is give people an opportunity to thank those animals for the contributions that they made to the war. You know, there's an opportunity to honor and remember soldiers through various things like the National World War I Memorial and through a lot of really excellent charities that are still helping veterans today. But there aren't a lot of opportunities available to just thank the animals who made such a great contribution. So through our Horse Heroes program, we're asking people to donate $1 in memory of every one of those 1 million horses. And the funds that we raise from that will then fund equine welfare programs. Brooke is the world's largest international equine welfare charity. We actually were founded right after World War I as a result of horses and mules who were left behind by the armies after the war.
I do know, in having read a little bit about this, that the military decided to abandon a lot of the animals because it was cheaper to leave them there than to bring them home, and that there was quite a bit of help that they needed.
Yes, just from the United States alone, with those 1 million animals that I mentioned, we only know of 200 animals that got to come home after the war. And for any of your viewers who may have seen the Steven Spielberg movie War Horse or the Broadway play War Horse, you know, that had a very happy ending, but that wasn't reality. These animals were left behind. They were the ones who survived. Were usually sold for slaughter, sold for hard labor, and so they ended up in really in worse condition than they were when they were in the war. That the charity that was started as a result of that is still operating today around the world.
Thank you so much for being with us today and telling us this fascinating story. That was Cindy, who is the Brooke USA Special Events and Outreach Manager.
Thank you, Teo.
Today in our spotlight in media, we just want to take a moment to remind you that the PBS American Experience documentary, The Great War, will be broadcast nationwide on April 10th. If you can't wait until then, stop by the American Experience website where they have 3 trailers posted. It's a really interesting series. Next, we have some new posts and articles to bring to your attention. The first one: 4 new exhibits on World War I open April 6th at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C. These exhibits are a collaboration between Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum and the National Museum of American History. The new exhibits will look at women in uniform, General John J. Pershing and World War I, Modern Medicine and the Great War, and the Artistic Expression of the Great War. Next, the article is the PAF, or Patrouille de France, is on the way to our centenary celebration in Kansas City on April 6. They arrived stateside over the weekend, and they greeted the nation with a flyover of the Statue of Liberty. The flyover and the PAF's North American tour serve as a specific thank you from France for Americans' early aviators who came to France to help during World War I. This week on the Wright blog, Fulbright scholar and World War I poetry expert Connie Ruzick presents Lieutenant John Hunter Wickersham. Connie is a university professor of English at Robert Morris University. She has a background researching the use of poetry in British centenary commemoration of the First World War. Her post this week focuses on Lieutenant John Hunter Wickersham, who was both a poet and a Congressional Medal of Honor hero. Moving on to the buzz, social media posts. We have with us Catherine Akey. How are you, Catherine?
Hi, I'm great. So March and Women's History Month are coming to an end. I wanted to highlight one final story coming from KTVQ, a news station from Billings, Montana. Army veteran Ed Saunders has been working for years to prepare for the dedication of a new memorial to women with ties to Yellowstone County who served in the military during World War I. Among those included will be a recent discovery of his, Regina McIntyre Early, an Army nurse who served in four hospitals in France during World War I. McIntyre Early was an enrolled member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes in northwestern Montana. Saunders says she could quite possibly be the first female veteran of World War I who was an enrolled member of an American Indian tribe in Montana, which is pretty awesome. The dedication ceremony in Billings, which will be conducted by Chapter 10 of the Disabled American Veterans, starts at 10 a.m. on April 6th on the courthouse lawn and includes the unveiling of a bronze memorial plaque. You can read more about this work that Saunders is doing at ktvq.com. Now, another story on this note of the Native Americans who served in this war. Some great news this week as regards the Lakota Code Talkers. Now, many of us are familiar with the Navajo Code Talkers of World War II, but Native American Code Talkers were common in World War I as well and came from several different language families and tribes across the U.S. This past week, 17 Standing Rock Sioux tribal members received posthumous Congressional Gold Medals for their service as code talkers during World War I. The award ceremony was held at the Wakpala Public School in Wakpala, South Dakota. Now, if the Native American story in World War I is of interest to listeners, I'd highly recommend they follow the Facebook page, World War I Native American Warriors. They share stories like this one, as well as photographs and biographies of the Native men and women who served in the conflict, and it's a really great resource for stories that otherwise can be hard to access. Okay, finally, we're heading into the myriad of April 6th celebrations and commemorations, and I wanted to take a moment to pause and remember John Christian Thurston. We shared an article this past week from Jimmy Price, who's a museum education specialist with the National Museum of the U.S. Army. This article was about Thurston, a young man from Richmond, Virginia, who gave his life in the Great War at the age of 22. He died on April 3rd, the anniversary of which is this coming Monday, in 1916. And if you're now thinking, isn't that a year before the U.S. entered the war? You're correct. Thurston joined the Canadian Expeditionary Force in order to participate in what he saw as an important conflict. We know, however, that after seeing action at Givenchy and Festubert, he wrote home that he had had enough and was going to ask for discharge. Unfortunately, he was killed in action at Ypres before that could happen. My point in bringing up this article and telling you all about this young man is to remind us that this war was long and grueling, and many Americans had found themselves caught up in it long before the U.S. entered the fray officially.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you to Mike Schuster from the Great War Project, Commissioner Monique Siefried from the World War I Centennial Commission, and Teresa Sims, Strategic Relations from the World War I Centennial Commission. John Marks from Saving Hallowed Grounds Memorial Tree Project, Cindy Ruhlman, Brook USA Special Events and Outreach Manager, Catherine Akey from our social media team, and Justin Mickens, our line producer for the show. I'm Teo Mayer. Thank you for your time, wisdom, and effort in bringing all this information to everybody. World War I Centennial News is brought to you by the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission and the Commission's founding sponsor, the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. The videos can be found at ww1cc.org/cn. Don't forget to sign up for our e-newsletter, The Weekly Dispatch. Our Twitter and Instagram handles are both at ww1cc and our Facebook at ww1centennial. Thank you for joining us, and don't forget to commemorate. So long.